Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Drive Through HR, the internet's number one HR talk show, coming to you every day. I am your host today, Crystal Miller, and I have our semi-permanent guest host on to help razz our guest who just joined us, Michael Heller. Our guest host would be Dwayne Lake, of course.
Hey.
So.
Hey. How are you?
Hello to the crew.
Yeah, it's a pretty good indicator if I'm here that your guest is not. So.
Wait, I'm here.
No, you weren't here when the show started. You don't get credit, okay? You're banned.
If I knew I was going to have two hosts, I don't know if I would have agreed to this.
Is it the fact that there's two or which two they are? I mean, let's be honest.
Well, I read somewhere that maybe Dwayne has the better sense of humor. Where did I read that? Anyway.
I think that's probably true.
Hey, do you know why they don't teach the alphabet in school during Christmas time?
No.
Noel.
Oh my God!
Yeah.
24/7 folks.
I told my 12-year-old that joke. He goes, "I've heard that one before." I'm like, "So the last time you heard it was the first Noel?"
Oh my! Excellent. Hello, you guys. It's nice to talk
with
us, Crystal and Dwayne.
Hello. I'm so glad you could join us. Sorry for the technical difficulties last week, man. It was literally the worst because we are so excited to have you here.
Crystal, what's my motto?
Mistakes are awesome. Okay.
So.
Here we go. Happy accident because now you get to talk to both of us in one show. So for anyone who doesn't know you, Michael, I think now would be a great time to introduce you and anything you want to talk about in relation to you, because this is your show.
Okay. Well, let me start off by saying that I've made a lot of mistakes across my life and professional life. But I've also made a lot of good decisions, too. And what I found is that while making the good decisions is excellent because you have that sense of worth and the sense of, hey, wow, look at me, I did something great, mistakes are really where I grew from. So, look, I am a kid that grew up in the Northeast. I grew up in New Jersey, went to school in Connecticut. I'm sort of a no BS guy. And anybody that knows me, including you, Crystal, and you, Dwayne, know that to be the case. I try to be as genuine as possible. And, you know, I've carried that through to my professional life. Went to school at the University of Connecticut, the one with the good basketball teams. And I, you know, use that in plural, because both the men's and the women's teams are fantastic. And I've been focusing basically on a career in human resources. I started as a recruiter at an agency and went in-house as a recruiter, led recruiting teams, led teams of HR, and then most recently launched a software tool that helps people communicate better around performance management.
And I love your software tool. So it is iReview for anyone who doesn't know. And Michael, what makes it cool?
Wow. What makes it cool? I think that part of the reason that I developed it is what makes it cool. I developed iReview out of frustration. I hated annual assessments. I hated performance reviews. And, you know, I'll ask you, Dwayne and Crystal, I mean, you've experienced them too. I'm sure you found some redeeming qualities out of them, but tell me about your general, you know, thoughts on annual assessments and performance reviews.
I don't know that I've ever experienced redeeming anything out of my particular performance reviews, but I know that there can be value to them. I just don't know that I got any out of it.
Okay.
So actually, my first real HR job was doing performance reviews. And so it was, I was in a construction type company, And at the time, so you're dealing with, you know, guys who work out in the field, who wear hard hats, who aren't on computers for the most part. The bosses were, but the guys weren't. And their performance reviews were on paper. They were 20 questions ranked on a scale of 1 to 100. And, yeah, and it had about a 30% take rate. No one would do them. And leadership couldn't understand why. So I was a you know, IT nerd they had brought in to do some other data stuff. And they said, hey, we got to look at this. And so, and this will tell you how nerdtastic it was. We actually rebuilt it in a Domino environment. So we built a Domino application for this thing. And we went from, okay, like, these paper, huge things to two different parts. One was we had eight characteristics that we decided were the ones our company cared about. And I don't remember them all, but they were things like drive for results, functional knowledge, emotional intelligence, you know, that kind of stuff. And you were ranked on a three-point scale. Towering strength at standard needs improvement. And then the second part was all about functional goals for the year. Here's the stuff you're supposed to accomplish. And how did you do? You know, blew it away, met standard, didn't meet. Right? Very, very simple, very straightforward. And while there's not a ton of, like, things you can really, like, sink your teeth into on something like that, for us, like, step one is, can we just get people to do it? Can we build something that people actually do for a couple of years to give us a baseline? And that got us there because it became easy to do. We had some consistency from year over year. So we had history that we started to build. And it really kind of, like, the thing I learned the most about it was the critical pieces are make it simple, make it as fast as you can, still getting all the relevant information, make it something that's repeatable year after year so that you can reuse the information and start to build some standards, and make it relevant to what people are doing. And if you, like, starting out with that, what I learned from that is that's not how most of them are built. Most of them are built, like, they're like policies, right? They're not meant to be used. They're just meant to document. So that was, like, my big first experience with performance appraisal.
Right. Well, Dwayne, I think I want to hire you to be my salesperson. If I could afford you, I would bring you on board.
Because I appreciate, honestly, that, but of course the good people at Dovetail have me busy on a daily basis.
Right, and no disrespect to Dovetail, but what I would say is that you're absolutely right, and I was frustrated as an employee because what I found is that a lot of the information that I received was either very recent, the last couple of months, didn't cover the whole year, or it covered something so long ago that I was never talked to about that I could have mm-hmm. maybe made a correction to while it was happening. As a manager, I had teams of 7-8 people up to, 20 people, not all direct reports, but you get the idea. And it took me on average about 2.5 hours to write these annual reviews because I had to collate all the data that came from lots of different sources and bring it all together and piece it together and then write something that was really meaningful. I really took these things seriously because what we're talking about are people's careers here. As an executive in organizations, what I found was I really wanted to tie overarching goal, which you talked a little bit about, Dwayne, to individual action. And that is a great way to measure that should be through the annual performance. Because of the reasons I mentioned and you mentioned earlier, it's never really a good way to see, is this really happening? And you have to sort of, put your finger in the air and see which way the wind is blowing to get a read on that as an executive. And then finally, Dwayne, you talked a little bit about this when you worked at the construction company. People just didn't want to do them. And the problem is that executives put a mandate on HR and other people put a mandate on HR, make sure these things get done. So now all of a sudden you have this competition or this bashing of we're not doing it because it's not important to HR saying you have to do it. So HR would chase everybody down to do it. And the reasons people didn't want to do them are just what you mentioned. They weren't simple. They had little to no meaning. And they just became something to procrastinate because it took up time in people's days. And what I've found is that I wanted to make a change. I wanted to do something different. So years ago, I read this article on HBR, and the article was about microfeedback. And I thought, well, what a great idea. Giving people, bullet point items as opposed to this long laundry list of feedback to accomplish next time around. And I said, well, what if we could do that and capture it in little quick bites or these bursts of microfeedback, as I call it, from employee to manager or peer to peer, whatever, however feedback is given at a particular organization. And that sort of was the premise behind iReview, which allows managers and others to give real-time microfeedback to their employees or people and let people take that information and act on it, whether it's keep doing what I'm doing well or change what I'm not. And then take all that information, aggregate it, and automatically populate an annual assessment. So managers don't have to spend as much time writing them anymore. So that's really, and Crystal, I'm glad that you like it. I think there's other people out there that like it as well. You know, it's one of these tools that is very simple, very mobile, and easy to use, easy to adopt. It takes, you know, not weeks to set up and configure, but hours or days to set up and configure. People can start doing this right away. So really, well, that's where the premise came from.
Yeah, well, and then I'm going to jump in here because I mean, like, we don't, and by no means do I mean to make this like a sales pitch for iReview, although, you know, that doesn't hurt anything, but that's not why you came on, and so I don't want to take up the whole time
right.
talking about it. But that being said, what I think the reason I like it fits really nicely into the show, which is that the real-time feedback is exactly what, to me, was missing in my performance reviews. Like, I can't even tell you how many things I've done in any given year to where you're talking to me about something that I may or may not have performed on track 10 and a half, 11 months ago. Like, it means nothing to me at that point. I can't course correct at that point. I can't learn at that point. It's kind of like a, oh, yeah, okay, next. So the fact that you can send someone, I mean, pretty close to instantaneous feedback on something that's relevant to what they're working on right now, positive, negative, whatever the case may be, that's something that's actionable and usable. So I like that because for mistakes to be awesome, we have to be able to learn from them.
That's right. That's right. I totally agree. I totally agree. But, you know, if anybody wants to find out more, contact me directly. You can go to iReview, spelled iReview.me, and find out more.
So now that part is, let's way over to some of the mistakes that, you know, you wanted to talk about today. So why are mistakes awesome to you?
Well, I mentioned it a little bit earlier, but I think about this quite frequently. When I manage teams, and even a philosophy that I abide by myself is that I'm okay with making mistakes, and I'm okay with my team making mistakes. There are a couple of rules that go around that, just sort of the sandbox to play in. One, be proactive in trying new things and trying to do things differently. As a result, you're going to make mistakes. So, great, we know that you're going to make mistakes. We'll own that. Two, if you've made a mistake and you recognize it, then let's not make that same mistake again. Because I forget who said it, but somebody really smart said that the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. So let's actually not be insane. Let's, if we find that we've done something wrong, let's change how we're doing it. You know, if you find that you hit your head against the wall and that it hurt, well, let's try something different. Try a different wall to hit your head against and see if it hurts there. Or try a different body part. Maybe a different body part won't hurt so much when you hit it against the wall.
There. Or you could just stop hitting against the wall. And
then if you do that, how will the wall ever learn?
Exactly. That's very true. That's
very
my point.
Much like daddy hits me because he loves me. Like, I don't know about that.
Right. Right. So sometimes the wall needs discipline. So yeah, I mean, those are some of the things. And you know, some of the mistakes come from the best possible intentions. You know, I was thinking back to some of the mistakes I've made before, and one was a really, I thought it wasn't even a mistake. So that's another thing. Sometimes you're not even aware of mistakes. Rely on others to let you know, hey, you screwed up. I was managing a team of about 8 people at a software company several years ago. And one of the people on my team, she was a recruiting coordinator, was in her early to mid-20s, came to me and said, hey, I wanted to let you know that I'm getting married on Friday, next Friday. And I was wondering if I could take a half day on Friday so that I could go and get married to my fiance. And I thought to myself, wow, how beautiful. Great. She can certainly have a half day off. Why would I deny her that? No big deal. And by the way, take a half day. Don't even bother, you know, using your vacation time for it. So, again, here I think I'm going above and beyond. So I gave her exactly what she asked for, and then I went above and beyond. So what happened from there was the rest of the team were congratulating her on Thursday, at the day before she was getting married. And they said to her, so are you going to do anything? Are you taking a honeymoon? She said, no, just tomorrow, very easy, light ceremony. And Michael gave me a half a day off. And everybody looked at her and then looked at me and said, wow, how generous. He gave her a whole half a day off. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a second, you guys aren't hearing the whole picture. She asked for a half day off. I gave her exactly what she asked for. My mistake wasn't thinking ahead and thinking, hey, by the way, why not give her a whole day off? Or, you know, doing something else for it. You know, I thought I was doing the right thing. Big mistake. And it was a perception mistake, you know, a big mistake. And my team jokingly never let me forget the fact that I made that mistake and only gave her a half day off, which was exactly what she asked for. But, you know, when I should have given her a whole day off or maybe more.
Well, I think maybe that's a lesson. That maybe is a lesson for her. Ask for what you really want. You know, if you only want a half day and that's what you ask for, that's what you're likely to get.
You know, and it's funny that you mentioned that, Duane, because I know Crystal wants to do this too. My next blog talk radio is going to be how to ask the right questions.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I do. Did we just? I feel like we should have you back on to talk about that soon.
Perfect. You see how I work myself in? It's very self-serving. I work myself in to just get more and more exposure.
Yeah,
like a tapeworm.
I was going to say or a fungus, some sort of
or
fungus,
either way.
Right?
Either way.
You guys, I'm telling you,
or Donald Trump
throwing down or not. but I will say it's kind of an interesting subject, right? Really timely because like I'm not going to blow any secrets or anything like that, but at the drive-through crew, we're talking about what we want to do for 2016 and like what mistakes did we make and how can we learn from it and where do we need to pivot. You know, like some of the things that we've talked about, like we just really like getting on and talking with cool people. Like we love that part, right? But this whole idea of, well, you were on a week ago, so clearly you can't come back on now. Yeah, well, I'm not sure about that. And fortunately, you know, neither are my co-hosts, so that's kind of cool. But, you know, like I think good conversation, much like good performance, is something that you want more of. And so, you know,
right.
If you have a good conversation with somebody or someone's doing a good job, you should foster that and maybe have them on again. And we certainly have good conversation with you, which I guess equates to good performance on the radio. So cheers. We'll have you on anytime you want to come on. Just drop me a note.
Hey, hold on a second. I've got about a half hour to 45 minutes left, and there's still a ton of time for me to screw this up. So I wouldn't commit to that just yet, Crystal. So,
okay.
You know,
absolutely.
Right. And it's funny, you know, one of the things I also talk about in terms of making mistakes. Yeah, sure. You know, it's easy to recognize, actually maybe not so easy to recognize a mistake when you've made it or when someone else has pointed it out to you. But, you know, when you think about after you've made a mistake, what happens, you can't always control what other people do or what other people say, but you can totally control how you react and respond to when something happens. So case in point, when this comes up, you know, what do? I look at everybody and I say, you know what? My bad. I totally made a mistake here. And yes, I'm going to pay for it. You guys are going to tease me about this. Probably you'll never forget when this happens. It actually came up a couple of months ago. This was years ago when it happened. But what I learned from it is just roll with it. It's okay if you make a mistake. Roll with it, learn from it, and move on. You know, Crystal, I know you're a little bit of a sports fan. Duane, I know you're a big sports fan. But one of the things that separates the greats from the mediocre professional players, who, by the way, are way better than any of us, are what they do when they commit an error on the baseball field or when they commit a foul on the basketball court. They shake it off. You know, the best quarterbacks will throw interceptions. But does that interception define what they're going to do on the next play? Probably not. Hopefully not. It's okay to make a mistake. Shake it off. Most mistakes are not these things that bear down on your life completely. So shaking off mistakes are very important as well, and being able to recover from them. That's what separates the great from the good.
Oh, I totally agree with that. I'm sure that Dwayne has some sort of a sports analogy he wants to throw out here, so I'll just...
Well, actually, I was going to say, where you see that most is they talk about relief pitchers, especially closers. They must have an extremely short memory, because you go out and get lit up one night, but your team needs you to still be that fireballer the next night. So you've got to be able to go out there and fail and take them out the next day with the same levels of arrogance and confidence that you always have, because when the game is so much of it is mental and attitude, you have to be able to forget those failures right away. But you remember who the hitter was that hit that 3-2 slider over the left field wall, and you don't throw him another 3-2 slider.
That's right. You know, and it's funny, you know, and again, I know a lot of people listening to these podcasts. Maybe they're sports fans or maybe they're not. But, I mean, even think about people in the working world. I'll use an example, Carly Fiorina. Think about how many times people have had to redefine themselves. Carly Fiorina has been fired from very, very high-profile jobs. Marissa Mayer from Yahoo had made a very significant, unpopular decision about a year and a half ago to take working from home away from the Yahoo employees. It could have been a huge mistake. It wasn't. You know, are they going to continue to try and buck the trend and push forward and reinvent how they do it? Absolutely. The reason they do that is because they realize, as leaders, you need to be able to make decisions based on limited information and recover from anything that maybe might not be the right thing because you have limited information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's always interesting to see the decisions being made and to sit back and in isolation be able to say, wow, that's a really bad decision, Melissa Mayer. How dare you? Like, who are you to take this stuff away from people? When I'll give you a more local example from St. Louis. When InBev came in and bought Anheuser-Busch, right, there were a lot of people that looked at the things that were being done and said, wow, I can't believe that they're going to get rid of Grant's Farm, and they're going to get rid of the free beer that they give to everyone. I can't believe they're doing all of these things. Well, what they didn't see is that there was this incredible culture of entitlement that started at the very top of Anheuser-Busch, which is why they were being bought out, because they had mismanaged some of the resources. And the best story I heard about it was they met in, if you don't know, InBev was based in Leuven in Belgium. And there was a meeting in Belgium, or I'm sorry, it wasn't in Belgium. It was in Brussels. It was still in Belgium, but it wasn't in Leuven. But they were meeting. And they were having a, you know, the executives from both teams were getting there. And at the end of it, the InBev guy said, oh, we've got to end because we have to get to the airport because our flight leaves in 2 hours. When does your flight leave? And the Anheuser-Busch all looked at each other and said, well, we brought our own plane on an international flight. We just brought our own plane. And all the InBev guys went, interesting. And that was one of the first things to go. And so if you see in isolation, they're closing Grant's Farm. They're taking away the free beer for employees. I can't believe they're doing these things. But if you see the whole picture going, hey, you guys are hemorrhaging cash, and we know how to run a company where you'll be fine and you'll have jobs and you'll be well paid and your compensation will be good and your benefits are good. You just will have to buy your own beer. So unless you see all of it, right, they look like bad decisions. Gosh, they don't care about these people at all. But it's really easy to be myopic about, like, what's happening in some of those decisions. It's fascinating to me.
Right. And when you think about what Marissa Mayer did, what she was trying to do was say, hey, when people are, quote, unquote, working from home, are they really working? Should we be encouraging them to do work? And, by the way, they turned out to be way more productive. So, you know, again, making – you know, and that will work for some cultures, may not work for others, but in her, and I bet you, if I had to guess, even though she publicly took that away and it was a mandate for a while, I bet you there are some people who still need to take care of a sick kid and they can work from home when they need to.
Well, I thought it was really interesting that, right, it wasn't too long after the announcement came out. It was, what, 6-7 months? Actually, I guess it was maybe more like 9, that she got pregnant.
Yep.
And there were a lot of, oh, so now that you're pregnant, now that you're having twins, let's see how you feel about working from home. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how that develops over time. So, but I'm curious from your perspective. So as somebody who's a leader, somebody who's, you know, leads organizations, who makes some of these decisions, who sees it with their clients on a regular basis, if you're in that leadership position and you're looking at the organization and saying, wow, we need a change to be made here, how much thought do you give to what are people going to think about this? I mean, that's all change management stuff, right? But do you spend more time on the change itself or on managing the change that's about to go out?
You know what? I don't think there's a formulaic answer to that, Dwayne. I don't believe that I can say, you know, I spend more time or 50% more time on the change or 50% more time on the communication of the change. I believe that it needs to be taken on a day-to-day basis. So an example would be, you know, when providing changes to customers, I think over-communication is very, very important. Because what customers aren't going to see right away is how the change benefits them. They're going to see, oh, my gosh, this is different. And most people will say, this is different. How does this impact me? People want to know what's in it for them. So when coming up with the change, a lot of times when we put together new features in our software or when we are trying to do something a little bit differently, we'll try and you know, give some really good customers or strategic people a little bit of a sneak peek. Hey, tell me what you think about this. How do you feel this would work? Can this help you? Would this not help you? How would you want to hear about this? And that's what goes into some of the communication of the changes that we do. But then over-communicating the change and letting folks know, don't worry, we're going to be here for you when this change takes place, is something that's very important. Recently, I'm getting into negotiations with a smaller company, but it's a strategic company. And they had asked us very point blank, well, what happens? We think we really like what you're doing, but what happens if you go out of business? What are the fail safes that you have in place? And they were looking for one particular answer. And my original answer was, well, we will probably go into detail about what that fail safe is going to be. But then, after doing more research, I went back to the customer and said, we could do this fail-safe. We're gonna ask you to fund it and pay for it. However, here's why you might not want to do that, aside from the fact of the cost. This fail-safe really doesn't do anything for you, and it's going to take much longer to get to your software if we go out of business. By the way, we're not planning on going out of business. We're planning on doing the opposite of going out of business, whatever that is. So little things like that, I think, you know, are crucial. Most importantly, over-communicating when a change is about to happen, making yourself available to when something happens. But, you know, when that happens, honestly, to come back to our point, there's going to be a mistake that happens. There's no question in my mind. There's going to be a mistake that happens. I'll let folks know this is not going to be infallible. Let's see how we can make this work. We're going to try and make this work together. If you notice something that isn't going the way you expected it to, let us know. Let's figure it out. Let's not just sit and dwell on it.
So there's a guy, Bob Lewis, who wrote a book called Bare Bones Project Management, and then he wrote Bare Bones Change Management. And they're both fabulous books. They're short, they're cheap, and everybody should have copies of both on the desk if you're doing any kind of project work. He's got a whole bit in there that I thought was really on point, kind of along the same lines. We keep being told that, like, people are naturally change resistant. Like, people are going to resist change. And he's right. It's nonsense. Because if that's true, we wouldn't have marketing, right? Because marketing is all about change. It's all about things being, you know, new and improved and lemon-scented, and that's how you get attention. So what people are afraid of is change that's going to impact them that they don't understand, right? And he used the analogy, like, if somebody offered to swap your car for your dream car, right, and they covered all the expenses on it, and, you know, would you do it? And most people say, well, yeah. Well, you're not afraid of that change because you know why it's helping you, right? So to your point, it's all about the communication because it's not about change. It's about fear, fear of the unknown, fear of damage, fear of pain. So it really is kind of about understanding what is it people actually care about, which is at the end of the day themselves. And that's okay.
Right.
There's nothing wrong with that. So, hey, look, people's livelihoods define who they are in a lot of ways, and it defines how you care for your family for most people. So there's nothing wrong with being afraid of change, nothing wrong with looking out for yourself there. So I'm curious, what would you say is the least successful change that you've ever tried to implement somewhere?
Let me think for a second.
Okay.
There have been a few.
It's easy to ask about the most successful, right?
Yeah.
That one's an easy one. What's the worst?
Yeah, I'll give an example. Back in my consulting days, I found that I was working with a client to do an assessment on their customer care group. So this is going to resonate with you, Dwayne, considering what you do and what you're doing for Dovetail.
Okay.
And the customer care group, it was a small group, and the organization has been around literally for over 100 years, and they were well-funded, and they were not going anywhere. But they recognized that in the past 100 years, things have changed, and that they want to try and do things a little differently. So my organization came in and said, we're going to do a really quick assessment on your customer care team, and we're going to evaluate some of the things you're doing well, some of the things you're not doing well, and come up with a report on what needs to be changed and some high-level approaches to changing it. Now, what the report's not going to say is here's all the steps required to change it, because that wouldn't be the purpose of this 6-week engagement. So customer agreed. We went through it. About 4 weeks in, the customer said, okay, we want to see where the report is at. And we gave them a very quick hit of the report. And they said, well, but wait, this isn't talking about how to do these changes. This is just talking about everything that you've identified. And I said, well, it kind of is talking about how to do the changes as well. But if you remember at the beginning of the engagement, we talked about how we're not going, the report isn't that, it's an assessment. It's a tool to help you. And conveniently, the customer forgot that. Now, part of it, I have to take responsibility for that, because I should have been communicating that to them each step along the way, both written and verbally. But at the end of the day, at the end of the project, the customer wound up canceling the project 90% done. We were at the goal line. 90% done.
Painful.
And by the way, I mean, they paid for it, but the communication that we got was, hey, this doesn't really tell us how to do what we need to do. And my communication was that was never the intent. But you learn from it. What did I learn from it? Well, if in the future, when taking on an engagement like that, remind them at every step, every chance you get, this is an assessment. This isn't a how-to document, because this will take doing all of these 10 things that we've identified will take a lot longer than a 6-week engagement. So live and learn.
I'm reminded there was a commercial, and the worst part, it's the worst kind of commercial, great commercial, and I have no idea who it was for. But it's got these, I want to say it was like a UPS, where they've got these consultants that are in the office with the boss. They're like, well, here's our analysis. And they give him the book, and he goes through the whole thing. Like, you should do X, Y, Z. This is what you really need to do. And he goes, sounds great. Do it. Like, what do you mean? Like, you're right. Let's go do these things. Like, oh, no, we don't do any of this. No. We just tell you what you should go do. Are you serious? You think we're going to do this work? No, that's all you.
There was a follow-up to that commercial that also.
Oh, really?
Said, yeah. We and the guy was holding his two hands as if he were holding a computer in between them, and moving the hands east and west and saying, no, you're doing it like this, moving the hands back and forth. He said, what you need to do is do it like this, holding his hands north and south and pushing them up and down. Same company, same sort of thing. Here, and then you see them walking out of there with that big check. Well, the bottom line
That's
is
awesome.
what we identified at the very beginning for this particular engagement was, we're going to do the assessment, and we're going to give you the high-level necessary items to know what to do and how to do it. But quite frankly, we recognize already all of the items in the assessment are too much scope for this one assessment, and we can help you with that afterwards. We're happy to do it afterwards, but it's not part of the scope of this assessment. But, like I said, live and learn.
Yeah, that's awesome. I never saw that follow-up. I have to look that
right.
up.
Now, another unsuccessful, personally, mistake that I made was not starting something soon enough. So, in other words, I feel like I've come up with several ideas over the past years that are Shark Tank worthy ideas. And I don't mean just that I would go on to Shark Tank, but I mean that people could buy into these types of things. And what I wound up doing in a lot of cases was sitting and ruminating on them and getting feedback and knowing that these were good ideas and then moving on to the next idea. So sometimes a mistake is doing too much analysis and not having enough action. Sometimes moving forward is a really, really good idea, even if you are going to have a couple of hiccups along the way. In the startup world, we call that, you know, understanding what not to do and then pivoting and then moving to something else.
I got
you know who was really
bad
about that? No, and then you can have it. You know who's really bad about that was Nikola Tesla. Tesla would go to the point where he would like get something to work like in his head, and he would build one model of it that worked, and then he would lose interest. And that's why he didn't have patents on most of the stuff he built, because he would like, yeah, it works. I've lost interest. I'm going to do something else.
Right, right.
So maybe it's a sign of genius.
Maybe.
Okay, so I have to say, for me, is one of the HR tech things that drives me insane. Like, you'll see these new products, and some of them are just fantastic products and really needed in the marketplace. And then what happens is the product development person will sit there and just over and over and over again try to perfect it. Well, you can't get perfect, so they just never launch. Or they wait so long to launch that someone bigger comes along and just gets it out there. And that's so sad to me, right? Because I've seen and talked with people who've just been crushed. It's like, well, I had this idea. This was my idea. And I was like, well, yeah, but it doesn't really count if you don't take it to market. So sometimes in the perfection of perfect, we make the mistake of never being able to get out at all.
Yeah. Which is why in the lean world, we tell you it's about continuous improvement.
That's right. And one of the things that you both have heard a lot, perfect is the enemy of the good. And getting to perfect is really hard. And, you know, to tie it back together, that's why mistakes are so important. Mistakes give people an opportunity to refine and, like you said, Dwayne, continuously improve. You know, it's a matter of being able to identify quickly where something needs tinkering and then fixing it. You know, we've had to do that quite a bit. And for me, there was no way the idea of iReview was going to get to that point, because, Crystal, like you had mentioned, I've seen other things move forward like that and not to get to that point. You know, an example, you guys are going to laugh about this. So my grandfather's grandfather was an inventor in around the Pittsburgh area of Pennsylvania. And he came up with an idea that baseball hats could be made as a one-size-fit-all by putting this plastic or some sort of adjustment on the back of a baseball hat so that not everybody had to get their own personalized hat. And it was the beginnings of the snapback, the plastic clicker that goes in that. And he went to his best friend and said, hey, let's do this. And his best friend said, great idea. So they started to work on it, put it together. His best friend took the idea from him, went, made millions, or probably hundreds of thousands of dollars at the time. And my grandfather's grandfather spent every dime he had trying to fight that in court and ended up basically penniless. But came up with the idea at first. Having a great idea is important. Executing on that great idea, not a lot of people can do that. It's one of those things that I'll never get into.
So it's interesting you say that. You know, there's so many people who talk about Apple. A lot of the, you know, big quote unquote innovations that Apple have had weren't theirs. It's somebody else's idea that they just improved on. The one I remember, like, people really, really getting all excited when they brought out the magnetic power cord, right? Mm-hmm. So when you trip over it, it just comes off. It's not all plugged in, so it's all safe. People are like, Apple's amazing. And it's like, they've been doing that on rice cookers in Japan for 20 years. Like, this is not new. It's just a new application of the same idea. But at the same time, they'll tell you, I've read and written about this idea that, you know, successful project management is only done in the last 10% of the project. Like, anybody can take a project to 90%. It's that last 10% where you actually deliver and you put things out into the world where then people can make fun of you and tell you how wrong you are. Like, that's the hard part. That's the part that's
absolutely
really valuable, getting somebody who can close.
Yep. Yeah, no question. Who can finish out the project. Like the relief pitcher.
Very much so. Which is why those dudes belong in the Hall of Fame.
Yep. Yeah.
All right. Well, I kind of lose you guys on the baseball talk, but this has been a really interesting conversation to me. And I think I've listened to more than I've talked, because it really is fascinating. There's a lot that you can pull out of this. Michael, before we go, if there's any one thing you want people to get out of this show or out of your experiences that maybe we haven't covered yet, what would that be?
I think right now, there's a lot of talk around our industry around two topics. One is engagement, and the other is millennials. And every HR practitioner, HR futurist will tell you that these are so important, these two things are so important to the future health and financial health of an organization. And there's so many pundits out there talking about millennials and what they are and what they aren't. And some of those things, a lot of those things, are very, very true. But there's a couple of things that I've found that are truths or realisms in this millennial culture. One, they're not afraid to make mistakes. They've been taught that no matter what they do, it's going to be good. It's going to be just fine. So we as other generations, and I'm not part of the millennial generation, we should take that into account when making decisions on their behalf or helping them to make decisions or bringing them into our organization. Very, very important. They're not afraid to make mistakes. And if they don't like something or the direction something is going, they'll make a change. They'll make it very quickly. And the second thing that I'll bring up about millennials and the level of their engagement is that in a lot of ways, millennials are just inexperienced workers or workforce. So, for example, when Generation Xers or baby boomers or the silent generation were in their 20s and 30s, early 30s, they also were in doing things with the same vim and vigor that millennials are doing now. Sure, millennials have more technology and are better with technology than we ever were and ever could be. But we have to remember where we were at their age and what we did. And as we do that, it should help us to make decisions on what's the new normal in an organization. And again, tying it back to our topic, encouraging folks, including this group, to make mistakes and to try something different is actually a good thing. You know, we can talk about best practices all day, but when it comes down to it, best practices work in a vacuum. I always like to talk about next practices. How can we use these best practices and modify them to make them work in a particular environment?
Oh, okay. Love that. Love every bit of that. And if you don't have that written down somewhere, you need to. So people can come over and over and over again. At the beginning of the show, you mentioned that we could find you at, how to find iReview. How do people connect with you personally?
Sure. Happy to take any questions or take any phone calls. I'm going to give out my phone number. So my phone number is 301-367-2852. My email address is mheller@engagient. That's how you say it, Dwayne. Engagient.com.
I think you're mispronouncing Engagiant. It's a big deal.
ENGAGIANT. And you can follow me on Twitter at Michael_Heller.
Yay. Engagient. I like the way that's pronounced appropriately, Dwayne.
Well, then you guys should stop saying it wrong.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. Dwayne, as always, it's lovely to have you on the show.
Yes, it is. It's been a pleasure to talk to both of you guys. Thanks again. And Crystal, I look forward to our next conversation.
Oh, me too. We'll get you on the books. Now, for everyone else listening, join us tomorrow where we will talk to Kyle Lagunas, who is the proprietor, principal research analyst. I don't know. We'll find out what his title is tomorrow of Lighthouse Research. So This will be really fun. Good conversation coming. I don't know if it gets top today, but Michael is pretty good. Thank you so much. Everybody have a great day. See you tomorrow.